Hello and welcome to the Beyond Biotech podcast number 64. I'm Jim Cornall and this is the weekly LaBiotech podcast. I'm putting this podcast together a little earlier than usual this week because at the time it normally goes out, I'll be doing some interviews at an event in the Baltics. It's always nice to be on the road, especially when the weather is decent, which it is supposed to be for at least some of the time. But then I live in Scotland, so I shouldn't be surprised at different kinds of weather. The last time I was in the Baltic countries was about 6 years ago. I rented a car in the Latvian capital Riga, then drove all over the three countries trying to figure out the various road signs in different languages and all of the speed limits. I was doing quite a lot of interviews there, so it meant the only capital city that I saw was Riga, but I really enjoyed my time in all three countries. I think the highlight being figuring out how to use the parking ticket machine in Tartu in Estonia, in spite of the language difficulties. I even got to see a football game in Estonia in Pärnu, of course not undercover, and about 5 minutes into the game the heavens opened. And the quality of the game matched the weather. Anyway, we'll see what adventures I have this time around. It seems a bit odd saying today is September the 22nd when it actually isn't when I'm recording this. It kind of reminds me about watching a Christmas special on television many years ago of an American singer that I won't name, where the singer was sitting on a park bench in London singing, or miming, a Christmas carol with a big winter coat on, with a fur-lined hood, and a young lady sat next to him snuggling up in her fur coat as well. The only problem was you could see the occasional person walk by in the background in shorts and t-shirts, and all the leaves were on the trees. Anyway, September the 22nd is International Astronomy Day, it's Hobbit Day, Doodle Day, and it's also World Car Free Day. If only that was the other way around and it was World Free Car Day. I couldn't find much in terms of science anniversaries, other than it was the birth date in 1791 of Michael Faraday, who was one of the most influential scientists in history. Amazingly, he was never knighted. These days I think you can be knighted for putting your recycle bins out every week for a year. Well, not strictly true, but the bar does seem to be set a little bit lower now. And I'm not just saying that because I've not been knighted yet. Anyway, as always, I digress. It's time for some current science, and this week we are talking about Portage Biotech, a company that is on a mission to expand the number of patients who derive long-term benefits from immunotherapies. Portage Biotech is advancing a portfolio of novel precision immuno-oncology therapies, including invariant natural killer T-cell engagers, which are designed to correct the tumor microenvironment and enable the body to recognize and attack tumors, and also next-generation adenosine inhibitors for a variety of cancers, with better potency, selectivity, and durability. Heading this drive is Dr. Ian Walters, Portage's CEO, and here is our conversation.
So I helped start what was the predecessor to Portage, which was really designed out of experience I had in big pharma. So prior to this, I was at BMS, and I was in charge of all the clinical trials for the oncology, and I also did business development. And really saw this revolution in the way we treat cancer and the way we think about treating cancer called immunotherapy, where we stop focusing on giving toxic chemicals with the hope that we kill some of the cancer cells before we kill normal tissue, to can we boost the immune system to fight the cancer for you? Because if we can train the immune system properly, it will continue to fight that cancer for the remainder of your life. So in the early days at BMS, we saw patients who were given 3 months to live, widespread cancer throughout their body, got an immune checkpoint inhibitor, boosted their immune system. The immune system found all the tumor in the body, cleared it, and those who were in response after 1 year were in response 10 years later. So for all effective purposes, cured. And that really changed our expectation. In the past, FDA would be willing to approve drugs that extended survival by 3 months. And here we're now talking about, can we get more than, 10% or 20% of these patients into long-term cure? It was amazing. And it really triggered an explosion of research in that area. And on the business development side, I was tasked to go out and look at all the research and all the science in this area to understand if there's opportunities to bring into BMS. So I was part of a large team that took a look at everything out there. And every time we noticed something interesting, when we brought it back to the senior leadership, they always said, well, you know, these small biotech companies, they don't develop drugs the way we do, or they don't have the right data. So why would we take a risk on some, you know, less understood technology? And that really triggered a thought in me, which is, well, maybe you need experienced pharma people in these small biotech companies to do that, to develop drugs the way pharma can, in a more nimble, more entrepreneurial way. And then, you know, when you get them to a certain point, you can flip them over to pharma to do the big kind of registrational studies. So that was the impetus for starting the company. I recruited a bunch of my fellow colleagues from BMS to join me in this effort, and we sought out to find technology. And the idea was, the discovery process is really long, expensive. It takes a lot of people, and there's no guarantee that you're going to discover anything. Whereas in the development process, if you have a product that has been discovered, that's really where you add the most value, and you have less risk, and you can really step in and help understand the development path and the trajectory and really make an impact on programs. So we went out and we really focused on novel mechanisms that are either best in class or first in class. And it was really based on this long experience we had at BMS and at other companies of developing the standard of care drugs in this area, to try to understand where the gaps are in the science, and then trying to fill those gaps with unique technology that we can really push quickly through the development process. So that was the impetus for starting the company. We have a variety of programs that we've brought in from different places, you know, in Europe, in the US. We've licensed from academic groups. We've acquired small biotechs. And, you know, we're now pushing those things through the clinic with the hopes of showing good activity in humans and then potentially partnering with big pharma. So we have four programs right now that are in clinical testing, and they stem from two different technology platforms that we acquired, one from a biotech, one from an academic group. And we're really excited about the progress that we've made since we found the company.
Could you maybe go into a bit more detail in terms of checkpoint inhibitors and what they are and how they work?
While at BMS, I helped on the team that developed the leading two checkpoint inhibitors. One is called anti-CTLA-4 and one is called anti-PD-1. Anti-PD-1 antibodies right now are the number one best-selling oncology drug ever. They are approved in about 14 different tumor types. They work by removing a break signal. So your body has a natural break signal that prevents your immune system from attacking normal healthy cells. And a cancer can co-opt that signal and hide from the immune system. The reason I don't have cancer today is because my immune system found the five cancer cells I developed yesterday and cleared those. Eventually, again, the cancer adapts and co-opts some of these signals to stop the immune system from attacking it. And those are the checkpoints. And there's a variety of them. There are now three approved checkpoints. As I said, PD-1 is the most common and the most widely used. And it's quite remarkable when you block that in a subset of patients, not everybody. There is a biomarker to try to identify tumors that have co-opted this signal. And they are certainly, if you have a high expression of that biomarker, you're much more likely to respond to those checkpoint inhibitors. And they are generally very well tolerated because we're not giving toxic chemicals. These are antibodies. They bind to normal parts of your immune system. The main toxicity associated with those is sometimes you unleash the immune system and it starts attacking normal cells, right? Because you want it to attack cells that express this molecule. And sometimes it attacks your normal cells. So you can get inflammation in different tissues of your body. If it's in the skin, that's a rash. If it's in your liver, it's hepatitis. Could be in the brain, could be in the lung. And fortunately, over time, we've learned how to stem that side effect. So we know how to dampen the immune system, and we do that by giving steroids and other types of treatments. So those are things that are generally well managed and don't lead to any fatal complications, but a good percentage of patients don't really have any significant toxicity from those therapies. So they've really become what I would say is a mainstay in the treatment of a lot of cancers. Like I said, there's about 14 different tumor types. And what's interesting and creates an interesting competitive dynamic in our field is that almost every company has decided to develop a drug that blocks this target. So this is the first time in the history of cancer where we have 13, 14 approved drugs with the same target without really significant differentiation between the products. You know, in the past, we would always be like, all right, well, if you're going to develop a drug in that space, it better be more effective or safer, right? Or more convenient. So instead of taking it once a day, if you could take it once a month, that would be an advance, right? Now we have many, many drugs really with a very similar profile, no difference in safety, no difference in efficacy. And that creates an interesting competitive dynamic because companies are building on these agents by combining with other mechanisms. And the only way to really differentiate yourself is to have a proprietary combination. And that's kind of where we fit in. We're developing those combination partners potentially, where we have partnered, you know, two of our programs with Merck. We just actually announced that today, our second partnership with Merck, where we're developing our drugs in combination with their PD-1 antibody. Merck is the number one best-selling PD-1. I think they're up to about $24 billion a year with this particular drug, and it's projected to go up to $34 billion in the next couple of years. They have a lot to lose if one of these competitors comes up with a better combination that can displace their sales. You know, on the other hand, BMS, you know, only selling about $6 to $8 billion a year. And some of the other pharma companies are only selling $1 to $2 billion. So they're all competing in the same space with very similar drugs, really looking for ways to differentiate. And that's where small companies like mine come in, who are developing novel technologies that could help these big pharma better differentiate.
Could you tell me a bit about the benefits and challenges of using checkpoint inhibitors?
You can take widely spread cancer and potentially cure it if the immune system finds it and is able to continue to fight it. Now, we talked about the mechanism sort of, and I'll use the car analogy again, which is taking your foot off the brake. Well, if you don't have someone pushing on the gas, taking your foot off the brake is not necessarily going to get the car moving. And if you don't have a skilled driver, the car is not going to know where to go. So those are other things that are needed in order to, for those checkpoint drugs to work. So for example, they work the best in two different indications, melanoma and lung cancer. The reason they work the best there is those are the number one and number two most mutated cancers, right? You're out in the sun getting UV radiation every day, you're breathing in pollutants. That creates mutations in your skin cells and your lung cells. And that's what leads to the cancer growth. Now, it's much easier for the immune system to recognize a highly mutated cell than it is a cell that looks like a normal cell, right? Again, your body's designed not to attack itself. That's the driver of the car, right? You need the ability to differentiate between a good cell and a bad cell. And those drugs don't typically work if you don't have what they call antigen recognition or the ability to recognize an abnormal cell from a healthy cell. The second is there already needs to be a pre-existing immune response. That's the person pushing on the gas. If there is a pre-existing immune response, then taking your foot off the brake allows that immune response to kill the cancer. So these drugs tend not to work in those settings where there's no recognition of the tumor and there's no pre-existing immune system. And that's a big focus of what we do from a mechanism side with our products is help identify the tumor, help promote an immune response, and then take your foot off the brake. So you combine with a Merck drug or some, you know, some other company's drug. When you have all three mechanisms firing at the same time, that's when you get long-term response. And that's the goal for us, right? To make cancer a chronic disease where you can live with your cancer for a long period of time, where your immune system is fighting it, and you don't require continuous therapy. That's another key benefit of this immune type of treatment. We found this out in the early days with our first checkpoint inhibitor, CTLA-4 at BMS, where we only dosed 4 doses and we gave it, you know, over a period of a few months. And like I said, patients had long-term benefit and didn't require continuous therapy. So they could go back to doing their activities really without a lot of long-term disability at all. And that's really the goal is to, you know, if you live longer, you want to have a good quality of life as well. And not requiring continuous toxic treatments for long periods of time as part of that equation.
You mentioned earlier about how some people that were treated were seeing a long-term response and not, to all intents and purposes, being cured. Why do some patients currently have such low response rates, and why is there such variation among people?
Melanoma and lung were the two most sensitive to this type of treatment. Things like pancreatic cancer, not at all. And unfortunately, it's not a very mutated tumor type, so there isn't recognition. And one of the things that's a hallmark of pancreatic tumors, it's very dense. It has a lot of fibrous tissue and it doesn't have a good blood supply. So when you take drugs IV, you can't necessarily get them into the pancreas. So almost no responses. An interesting case is colorectal cancer. So when we did our first in human study at BMS of the checkpoints and colorectal cancer, we treated 50 patients and only one responded. So that gave us an opportunity to look at that one patient and see what might make it different. It turns out that one patient has a DNA repair issue. So your body has the ability to repair damage to your DNA, and there's certain genetic defects where you can't repair that damage. So the DNA damage builds up, and lo and behold, again, much easier for the immune system to recognize tumors with a lot of DNA damage, a lot of mutations. That's called microsatellite instability. For the first time, the FDA went ahead and approved a drug, not for a specific tumor type, but for all tumor types that have this MSI high, microsatellite instability. And you know, it wasn't BMS, it was another company that did a trial. And again, irrespective of tumor type, which was not the norm at the FDA, and showed that if you have this genetic defect, you're more likely to respond to immunotherapy, and you can take a tumor like colorectal, which we would have just killed because 1 in 50 is not enough of a response rate to get a drug approved. But when you look at MSI high, you know, all of a sudden your response rate's 40 or 50% in that subset of patients. So the general theme, and it's been certainly harder with these immune-based therapies, is how do you identify the right patient? And what can we learn about a patient? Now, it's certainly easier, and you're probably familiar with drugs like HER2, right? Which is a genetic abnormality seen in breast cancer and gastric and a few others. It's something that you can look at a cancer cell. Does it have it? Does it not have it? And if it has it, you're more likely to respond. One thing about these genetic abnormalities is they're highly conserved. They don't change over time. You have it when you're diagnosed. You have it later on when you have metastatic disease and so on and so forth. When we're talking about immune-based therapies, we're not looking at genetic abnormalities in the cancer. We're looking at the body's immune system. And that's a dynamic system that does change over time. So if I look at a biopsy that you had when you were first diagnosed, and it's been 3 years and you've had 10 therapies and you now have metastatic disease in different organs, that could be completely different than the tissue that you had on record when you were diagnosed. And obviously the immune system is highly complicated, and we're not, you know, there's a few of these genetic abnormalities, like I told you, microsatellite instability. We haven't really identified too many of these other things that are abnormalities in the immune system where we can do a test and determine which patients. That is a passion and a focus of ours, is trying to put the right drugs with the right patient And, you know, we do analyze tumor tissue before treatment, after treatment. In some cases, we do have tests that we're developing that patients can take before they come on our drug to see if they're more likely to respond. I mean, I think that's the holy grail of drug development, is putting the right drug to the right patient. The challenge sometimes is if that abnormality is only in 4% of the patients, like MSI, you know, as a doctor, you're going to have to go in and you're going to test 20 patients, and the probability is none of them will test positive, right? And then you sort of lose enthusiasm to keep testing for those particular markers. There's a balance between the right drug only works in a tiny fraction of patients, and how do you develop something like that? It costs a lot of money to do all the testing, to get people motivated, and so on, versus we're going to test in all comers and know that 50% of those really can't benefit from the drug because they don't really have that biology. So it's a balancing act. And then we try to, you know, work within that to try to identify ways to enrich our studies so that the right patients are being matched with the right drugs.
You mentioned that there were a lot of similar drugs in the same space. As a company, how are you planning to kind of change that landscape in immunotherapy?
Yeah, so we like the dynamic because it's a dynamic that from a business perspective, we can play off of. And like I said, we have chosen to partner with Merck, who is the biggest player in that space on the development of our drugs. But, you know, when you do these collaborations, when we do collaborations with Merck, you know, they provide us their drug to test with our drug. And they get the right to see the data before anybody else. And that's it. They don't own us. They don't own what we can do. And we can certainly go out and shop this to all of Merck's competitors once the data has been made public. So it's an interesting dynamic because, like I said, Merck has a lot to lose and these other companies have a lot to gain. And that really has driven up the amounts of money that companies are willing to pay to acquire these. So a good example of that was BMS acquired a product from Nektar. It was immunotherapy, and they valued it at about $10 billion upfront. And that's after Nektar had treated about 42 patients. Unfortunately, that drug was studied in a large randomized phase 3 trial by BMS and found completely negative, and then that program was stopped. But it tells you a little bit about the stakes in this area financially and what these companies have to do if they want to compete. So we like that dynamic. We are certainly not trying to develop a me too to PD-1s to try to compete with all those others. We're really focusing on drugs that work by themselves. That's an important point. A lot of these immune therapies require combinations, and the Nektar example that we just talked about that turned out to be negative did require a combination with a PD-1 and was not very active on its own. That's creates a whole different ball of challenges if your drug doesn't work by itself. So we, you know, have really worked hard to identify drugs that work by themselves where we can get them approved as a monotherapy. But we know one drug is not going to cure all of cancer, right? And the PD-1s don't, like I said, in different tumor types, it ranges anywhere from 10 to 30%. However, when given in combination, you can see those numbers bump up to 40 or 50%. And that's what we're trying to do, is to bump those numbers up with our drugs. So we are studying them in combination. We are studying them by themselves. And we're trying to play in this competitive dynamic to create competitive tension. And part of the way we do that is leveraging our relationships with the pharma companies. So, you know, myself and my team, we've been around for 20 to 30 years in this space. We know a lot of the players, and we speak to the pharma companies most likely to transact with us on a regular basis and share our progress, share information about what we're doing, get their feedback. Because the idea is, if you build it, they will come. I don't believe that. Right. Having been on the other end on the BD side and said no to thousands of companies, you know, you need to be sure that the work that we're doing is in line with what those companies are looking for in order to enter a deal with us. So that's a big part of our strategy, is to vet and quote unquote pre-sell our trials and the data that we're generating to make sure that when the data matures, that it will be sufficient for those companies to make us an offer.
You mentioned that you just struck a second deal with Merck that was announced today. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
We have two key platform technologies. The first one and the most advanced stimulates a type of immune cell called an invariant natural killer T cell. And it's a small molecule. It's not a protein. It's not a cell therapy. It's a small molecule, which is very inexpensive to make. And we're doing a study with Merck and their PD-1 with that drug. So we have a very good relationship with the company. Our second platform technology is another small molecule that blocks adenosine. And you probably have heard of the word adenosine, ATP, and all those kind of things that we learned in high school biology. Well, it turns out in cancer, cells are reproducing so much so quickly. There's all this ATP production, and then they release adenosine outside the cells. And that adenosine, believe it or not, inhibits the immune cells from killing it. And we have a way to block that. And the deal we announced this morning was, again, a collaboration. We have a trial. We have two different adenosine drugs. They're both oral. And we are developing, like I said, tests for each one of these to try to match them to the correct patients. We are one of the only companies that has all the different ways of modulating adenosine within one company. So Merck saw that and said, look, we would like to work with you. We have an adenosine 2A inhibitor, and we're combining that with PD-1. We have an adenosine 2B inhibitor, and we're combining that with PD-1. And then we're doing the triplet, the A2A, the A2B, plus PD-1. So really having all the different ways to modulate this biology is what attracted Merck. So they're providing Keytruda for this trial to do these three different combinations.
So where's that study at right now? Is it right at the beginning?
It's early on. We're still in the phase one dose escalation part of the study. It's an ambitious study. It has multiple components, both monotherapy and combination. So like I said, it's very important to us to show that our drugs work by themselves. And there's certainly a track record of similar drugs showing single agent activity. So our first aim in the study is to show the drugs work by themselves, especially in that biomarker driven patient population. So we first need to dose escalate and establish a dose that we feel is safe. And then we will expand in certain tumor types, again, selected by using our own biomarker. Now, while we're doing that, we're collaborating with a bunch of academic groups. One of the ways we keep our team lean and keep the cost down is through collaboration. So we collaborate with academic groups. So several different academic centers are testing for us. And we also have an agreement with the National Cancer Institute, which is the NCI part of the NIH, where we have a lab there, and we've sent them our adenosine drugs, and they're testing them as well. And depending on what we see in that, we've already tested in animals with the PD-1 and shown that that's beneficial. So we plan on launching those type of combinations, but we also plan on combining with some of our other drugs as well. So the second part of this trial is combinations, and it's adaptive, and it's designed to look at a lot of things depending on what the science dictates. So we'll do combinations first for safety. And if we identify a safe dose, which we anticipate because these things don't have overlapping toxicity for the most part, then the trial morphs into more of an efficacy assessment where we'll look at, so if for PD-1 is the example, we'll look at PD-1 alone versus PD-1 plus our adenosine. And the importance of doing that is showing the contribution of your new drug over the PD-1 or the standard of care. So the big pitfall that many companies fall into is they jump into a combination, they do their drug plus PD-1, and they see responses, and they get excited, and they move the product forward, but they don't really know if those responses were due to the standard of care, PD-1, alone. They were due to their drug alone or somehow the combination of the two. So it's an important component of trial design is to dissect out those components. So we feel that you need to do a randomized study and you need to show that the new drug is adding something on top of the standard of care before you can move that forward in development. And that's kind of what the big pharma companies are telling us they want to see as well in order to make a decision about acquiring or licensing the technology.
Are there any current challenges to putting trials together?
You know, we're still living in the post-COVID era. I can't even tell you. In the US, it's a little bit less of an impact on the clinical trial ecosystem. In the UK and Europe, it still has lingering effects. I mean, we have submitted an application in Europe in January. These applications usually are 30 to 60 day review. And we still haven't gotten formal comments. And we're now in September. And that's administrative, you know, lack of resources, the regulators. You know, the UK used to be relatively quick. We're hearing that they're still backlogged and taking time. You know, we have an ongoing trial in the UK because that's where one of our technologies came from. Forget about the regulators. The hospitals during COVID had to pause all clinical trials and started creating a wait list and a backlog. So even they like your trial and they want to put patients on and they have patients dying for all intents and purposes, they have an administrative backlog where they can't activate you for another year because that's how much you know, trials are in the queue. So, you know, it's really unfortunate that, you know, patients who need these therapies may not be able to access them because of this lingering effect of the great resignation in the UK and lack of resourcing at hospitals and regulators and so on. And, you know, we try to mitigate that by broadening our scope and going to areas that have been less harder hit so we can make progress. But I wish it wasn't the case. You know, my goal as a doctor is to get these drugs to patients as quickly as possible.
In terms of the end patient, are you optimistic in the long term that we'll get closer to cancer being something manageable?
So it's always funny because the lay population, when they hear that you work in cancer research, they always think, oh yeah, you guys have the cure to cancer and you know you're keeping it back because it's not good for business. That's certainly not the case. Like I said, this checkpoint market is predicted to be $100 billion a year. It is good business. And, you know, we are curing certain percentages of different tumor types, but it is the fraction of patients. And the goal is to really get more patients into that response. So I'm encouraged by the rate of innovation in this area. And technology has certainly enabled new types of treatments to come that we never thought could be possible. But it's not going to happen overnight. And you know, I think one of the biggest challenges to progress is people's willingness to participate in clinical trials. Everyone feels, especially in the US, they don't want to be a guinea pig, right? So they don't want to be, you know, tested on. And I think the rate that I've been told is about 5% of patients who are eligible to participate in clinical trials in the US actually do. So we have more products and more trials than we have patients. And that is the rate limiting step to progress. And I would love for that dogma to change and for people to be more willing. I mean, the types of drugs we're testing now are not like we did 20 years ago. These are heavily engineered products that are mimicking normal processes in your body. They don't have the same kind of toxic potential. I can tell you our iNKT agonist, at the highest dose that we tested in our phase one, there was almost no toxicity. I mean, like a little mild headache, a little fatigue and fever. I woke up and I had a headache this morning. You know, I mean, it's not any different than what normal people experience on a regular basis, right? So this is, you know, the new era of treatment. It's not things that are going to make all your hair fall out and you're going to be in the bathroom all day and things like that. So people really need to open their mind with participating in clinical trials. That's something that I feel is very important. And I encourage everybody who reaches out to me to participate. And part of it is doing good clinical trials. And not everybody does. It's an art on how to do these things. And, you know, you need people like me and my team who've been doing it for 20 plus years, who have a track record of success. I mean, our team has now contributed to 10 products being approved in oncology, right? So we know what we're doing on that side. And I think that's really important because I see a lot of bad studies out there that unfortunately don't lead to anything. And at the end of the day, if you're going through this effort and expense and you're exposing people to drug and you're collecting tumor and blood samples, you want to make sure that A, you advance the science, and B, hopefully you're helping a product get to patients ultimately and approved.
You mentioned the problems with clinical trials. What do you think the solution is to getting more people involved?
I know that some of the trade organizations are trying to do some PR and to help dismiss some of the myths around clinical trials. You know, I think it also has to be a conversation at the doctor level, because if doctors are not mentioning it, then patients are not going to know about it. It's really remarkable to me, having worked with the best cancer centers across the world, how different your treatment might be if you're being managed at Sloan Kettering than if you're being managed at a local community hospital in a suburb. You know, people don't really understand the disparity in treatment and potentially outcomes as well, depending on how you're managed. It's not like you get diagnosed with a cold, you can go to 10 different doctors, they give you 10 different antibiotics, and you get better no matter what. This is, you know, life and death. And, you know, a couple of my friends and colleagues are doing their best on social media to create awareness and to help people understand what options are. I know the patient support groups are also trying to advance this mission. So it's really a multifocal approach from all angles, right? From the press, like what you guys do, from patient support groups where newly diagnosed people go to get information, from doctor influencers, which I would, you know, not a term I would use, you know, 10 years ago, but is, you know, becoming a bigger component of our ecosystem, from politicians, and certainly the Cancer Moonshot Program and things like that are helping push the mission. So I'm hopeful that, you know, we'll continue to see an acceleration of this attack.
I definitely learn a lot from the guests. I think I even almost impressed my own doctor last week with my knowledge of what's happening in drug discovery. Not enough to get me that knighthood, though. Just a quick reminder to check out all of the latest news and articles over at labiotech.eu. And I hope wherever in the world you are, you have a great week ahead. Thanks for listening, and that you'll join us next time for another Beyond Biotech.